From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I think it was the success of the Iran coup and the Guatemala one that followed 10 months later that sent the U.S. government off on this direction of covert action and regime change. The Iran coup was the first time the CIA ever overthrew a government. And Harry Truman never wanted the CIA to go in that direction. I even found a phrase in one of his diaries. He used the phrase American Gestapo.
Today we look at two coups in history. The one that toppled the democratically elected leader of Iran 50 years ago, and the attempted coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002. This as the 15 members of the Caribbean community are calling for a probe into whether the U.S. kidnapped Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide and orchestrated a coup. We'll go to Jamaica for a reaction. And we'll pay tribute to the great New Yorican poet Pedro Pietri, who died Wednesday at the age of 59.
They were always on time. They were never late. They never spoke back when they were insulted. They worked. They never went on strike about permission. They never took days off that were not on the calendar. They worked 10 days a week and were only paid for 5. They worked, they worked, they worked, and they died.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newsday's reporting a federal grand jury has subpoenaed records of calls made from the president's Air Force One in the week before the name of a covert CIA agent was leaked to the press last year. The grand jury has also subpoenaed records from the White House Iraq Group, a little-known internal task force established in August 2002 to help publicize the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. Regular participants in the group included Bush's senior political advisor, Karl Rove, strategist Karen Hughes and Mary Madeline, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, and Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff, Louis Libby. Also subpoenaed were records of contacts between the White House and more than 24 journalists and media outlets. The grand jury's trying to determine who within the administration outed the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame to conservative columnist Robert Novak. Plame is the wife of former U.S. diplomat Joseph Wilson, who is an outspoken critic of the Bush administration. The Washington Post is reporting that the U.S. intelligence community based its claim that Iraq had mobile biological weapons labs on a single Iraqi defector who was never even interviewed by any U.S. official. The U.S. received the information from a foreign intelligence agency. The man, a former Iraqi chemical engineer, turned out to be a relative of a senior official in Ahmed Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress. The INC is a group of Iraqi exiles who actively backed the United States to invade Iraq, have been accused of providing the U.S. with fabricated intelligence on Iraq's weapons programs. The Senate's most senior member, Robert Byrd, has called on Congress to create an independent Iraq Intelligence Commission because he questions the independence of the panel appointed by President Bush. Byrd said, quote, "The president has described the panel that he created as an independent commission. Well, nothing could be further from the truth." Meanwhile, The Hill is reporting that the White House is rebuffing a request by Senator John McCain to give the president-appointed Iraq Intelligence Commission power to subpoena records. And the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, is appearing today for questioning on Iraq intelligence in a closed session of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He appeared before the Senate Intelligence Committee in closed session yesterday. In Iraq, the Pentagon's most senior commander, General John Abu Zaid, has admitted it is possible Iraq could descend into civil war. In campaign news, a new Associated Press poll has found that in a three-way presidential race between George Bush, John Kerry, and Ralph Nader, Bush would narrowly beat Kerry. The poll put Bush's support at 46%, Kerry at 45%, and Nader at 6%. The Los Angeles Times is reporting Reverend Al Sharpton may soon drop out of the presidential race if Senator John Kerry agrees to adopt a more pronounced urban agenda. Republican Oklahoma Congressmember Tom Cole came under criticism yesterday for his comments on the significance of November's presidential election. He recently told an audience in Canada, quote, "If George Bush loses the election, Osama bin Laden wins the election. It's that simple. It will be interpreted that way by enemies of the United States around the world." 8 anti-war protesters will be appearing in court later this month following their arrest during a recent Army-Navy basketball game. They were arrested for standing in the last row of the bleachers wearing T-shirts that spelled out, quote, "U.S. out of Iraq." The 8 activists, who included 2 veterans, were arrested for trespassing and disorderly conduct. A 3-month Senate investigation has found top Republican staffers systematically downloaded over 4,600 computer files from Democratic offices. The investigation was carried out by the Senate's top law enforcement officer, Senate Sergeant at Arms William Pickle. He made no recommendations about whether to pursue criminal prosecutions, but said several federal laws were likely broken. The report identified 2 staffers, including Manuel Miranda, who became Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist's top aide on judicial nominations. Both Miranda and the other staffer, Jason Lundell, left their Senate jobs during the investigation. This news from Venezuela. The country's ambassador to the United Nations resigned yesterday in protest over Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's handling of a referendum on his presidency. The ambassador said citizens should be allowed to vote on whether they want the democratically elected Chavez to finish his term. He also accused the National Electoral Council of engaging in, quote, very tricky action after it questioned the authenticity of 800,000 signatures on a presidential referendum. The states of South Dakota and Wyoming both abolished the juvenile death penalty this week. 31 states now bar the execution of youthful offenders for crimes committed at the age of 16 or 17. And the world's largest organization of anthropologists have responded to President Bush's charge that same-sex marriage poses a threat to our civilization. The executive board of the American Anthropological Association issued a statement reading, quote, "The results of more than a century of anthropological research on how either civilization or viable social orders depend upon marriage as an exclusively heterosexual institution. Rather, anthropological research supports the conclusion that a vast array of family types, including families built upon same-sex partnerships, can contribute to stable and humane societies." This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Just days before Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was removed as Haiti's leader forced out of the country, he had signed what was being billed as a U.S.-backed peace plan between his government and the opposition. The proposal was initially put forth by the 15-nation Caribbean Community, CARICOM. Even though the plan was widely viewed as favorable to his opponents, Aristide signed the agreement that would have greatly reduced his powers and given the post of prime minister to a figure acceptable to the opposition. The groups and organizations opposed to Aristide delayed responding to the proposal as the paramilitary forces led by Guy Philippe, Jodel Chamblain, and Jean Tatoune continued to grab more territory in Haiti. Ultimately, the opposition rejected the plan, saying they would only accept Aristide's removal from power. This week, the CARICOM nations called for a United Nations investigation into the circumstances of President Aristide's departure from office and from Haiti. They were joined yesterday by South Africa. In a statement, the South African Foreign Affairs Minister expressed concern at allegations Aristide was forced to leave the country. Foreign Minister said if it's true, it will, quote, have serious consequences and ramifications for the respect of the rule of law and democracy the world over. To get a perspective on how the removal from Aristide is playing in the region around Haiti, we go to Kingston, Jamaica, to John Maxwell, a veteran Jamaican journalist, has covered Caribbean affairs for more than 40 years, currently a columnist for the Jamaica Observer. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thank you, Amy. More than 50 years.
Well, it's good to have you with us after your half a century of work. Can you talk about the CARICOM demand for a UN investigation into the ouster of Jean-Bertrand Aristide?
Well, basically, the prime ministers just didn't buy the story, which was being sold by the U.S. administration. They said that the various members of the group had been speaking to, including particularly Prime Minister Patterson of Jamaica, had been speaking to Aristide, you know, for hours on and off on Saturday, and had absolutely no information from him that he had intended to go anywhere. And so they think that what happened is extremely suspicious. And I imagine that they are very much aware that if it can happen to Aristide, it could also happen to them or to any other small country. And so they want the United Nations or a body appointed by perhaps the General Assembly of the United Nations. I don't know whether it could be the International Criminal Court or the International Court of The Hague to investigate what happened so that the whole thing can be put on the table and whoever is responsible for whatever is identified and, if possible, I suppose, punished. One of the things that they wanted is to return to democracy, which, from the way I read that, it means that they want Aristide reinstated because they believe that he was improperly removed from office.
What about the significance of South Africa joining with the CARICOM nations in calling for the investigation?
It's very significant because South Africa is the most powerful black country on earth. And Thabo Mbeki represents a South African view that Haiti is a beacon for the black world. Excuse me. In that it was the first country of slaves. It's the only country where the slaves abolished slavery. And that it took the time to finance people like Bolivar, who went on to liberate South America, and that they were consciously, selling the idea of liberty and freedom or helping people to attain their freedom, you know, during the early years, and that this is something, you know, which should be saluted and protected. Also, you know, the fact is that the people think that the Americans went into Haiti once in 1915 and that's it. But there's a book by a lady called Mary Renda, which is called Taking Haiti. And there are other documents too, which show that the Americans went into Haiti at least 10 times before 1900, you know, trying to fix things the way they wanted it. And the fact is that between, say, 1860, when the Americans recognized Haiti, and 1994, when Aristide was replaced in power, the Americans have never, ever been out of control of what's been going on in Haiti. So, you know, what South Africa is looking for, with the rest of us, is to achieve a kind of autonomy for the Haitians.
We're talking to John Maxwell, columnist with the Jamaica Observer. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, the point is that we believe that what happened in Haiti is a symptom of the profound disrespect that the Bush administration has for black people particularly, and for small countries also. Excuse me, this is not the first time. You know, in an article I wrote earlier this year called Imagine Niggers Speaking French, that was a direct quote from the American Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, when he discovered who the Haitians were, you know. And the people who went in the first occupation treated Haiti in such a way, they called everybody niggers. They said that that they were just hapless, you know, happy-go-lucky characters who couldn't do anything. The fact is that in the previous 100 years, the Haitians had been able to survive, had a viable country going, despite the harassment of the United States and France, and they were no more or no less able to control their own affairs and do their own thing than any other country in the world. In fact, some English writers and some Americans, you know, looked at Haiti as an example of how well blacks could govern themselves. And one writer, I can't remember his name at the moment, an Englishman, said that Haiti provided an example which should shame some of the Anglo colonies and ex-colonies in the hemisphere. So, you know, what we're talking about is you give a dog a bad name and then you can beat the devil out of him. And this is what has happened to Haiti. And people here are very upset about it. I mean, the ordinary population of Jamaica is extremely upset about it. People, Jamaicans in the United States are writing letters to their newspapers here, approving of what the CARICOM has done and urging support for Haiti. People are very upset because this, you know, seems to them to be, you know, the utmost in prejudice and discrimination and American exceptionalism. You know, when you look at the people who were in charge in Haiti a couple of days ago, these are terrorists. The Americans are trying to get the Jamaican government and the governments all over the world to pass an anti-terrorism legislation, you know, which would, for instance, in the case of Jamaica, those guys that you just spoke about who were arrested at this game for wearing a U.S. out of Iraq T-shirts, you know, we suspect that if people did something like that down here under the new Anti-Terrorism Act, they would like to be arrested and jailed without any problem, you know, without any recourse. And what happened to Aristide is more or less what happened to the people in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, you know, except that he was a little bit too important to just disappear without a trace. But the whole disrespect for human rights that is displayed by the United States in its foreign relations is something that concerns us down here and makes people very angry indeed.
Well, John Maxwell, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We will certainly continue to follow the story and see how the United Nations responds to the CARICOM calls, the 15-member Caribbean community now joined by South Africa's call for an investigation into the circumstances of the ouster of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide from Haiti.
I'd like to congratulate you for breaking the story about Aristide, you know, about his kidnapping, because that's a criminal offense. And if it weren't for you, I don't know when we would have got that story out. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And folks can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear all of our special coverage on Haiti. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at two coups in history, Iran and Venezuela. Stay with us.
May I be peaceful and happy? May I be healthy and strong? May I be free from fear. May I be filled with loving kindness. May you be peaceful and happy. May you be healthy and strong. May you be free from fear. May you be filled with loving kindness. May presidents and prime ministers, dictators and despots, May they be peaceful and happy. May they be healthy and strong. May presidents and prime ministers, dictators and despots, may they be free from fear. May they be filled with loving kindness. May we all be peaceful and happy, healthy and strong, free from fear. May we all be filled with loving kindness.
A Buddhist Prayer by David Budbill. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. The apparent coup d'etat in Haiti last weekend and the mysterious circumstances surrounding the removal of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide from the country evoke images of what can only be described as U.S.-orchestrated coups past. Today we're going to look at two of these. The 1953 coup against the democratically elected leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, and the April 2002 attempted coup against Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. This week, I went to Chicago to speak at the Chicago Public Library. Afterwards, I met with Stephen Kinzer, author of the book All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. The New York Times reporter talked about the 1953 coup against the Iranian leader.
The story of how the CIA overthrew the government of Iran in 1953 is really an object lesson in how easy it is for a rich and powerful country to throw a poor and weak country into chaos. The CIA sent one of its most adept operatives, Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, to Iran with the mission of organizing the overthrow of the government. One reason I was so interested in writing this book is that I've always asked myself, how do you go about overthrowing a government? What do you do? Suppose you're sent to a country with that mission. What do you do on the first day? How do you start? Then what do you do? Well, now I know. Kermit Roosevelt set about trying to create chaos in Iran, and he was able to do that very quickly by a series of means. The first thing he did was he started bribing members of parliament and leaders of small political parties that were part of Mossadegh's political coalition. Pretty soon, the public started to see Mossadegh's coalition splitting apart and people denouncing him on the floor of parliament. The next thing Roosevelt did was to start bribing newspaper editors and owners and columnists and reporters. Within a couple of weeks, he had 80% of the newspapers in Tehran on his payroll, and they were grinding out every kind of lie attacking Mossadegh. The next thing Roosevelt did was to start bribing religious leaders. Soon, at Friday prayers, the mullahs were denouncing Mossadegh as an atheist, enemy of Islam. Roosevelt also bribed members of police units and low-ranking military officers to be ready with their units on the crucial day. And in what I think was really his masterstroke, he hired the leaders of a bunch of street gangs in Tehran, and he used them to help create the impression that the rule of law had totally disintegrated in Iran. He actually, at one point, hired a gang to run through the streets of Tehran, beating up any pedestrians they found, breaking shop windows, firing their guns into mosques, and yelling, "We love Mossadegh and communism." This would naturally turn any decent citizen against Mossadegh. But Roosevelt didn't stop there. He hired a second mob to attack that first mob, to give people the impression that there was no police presence and order had completely disintegrated. So within just a few weeks, this one agent operating with a large sum of cash and a network of contacts in various elements of society had taken what was a fairly stable country and thrown it into complete upheaval.
And then can you talk about how the coup was actually carried out?
The first coup that Roosevelt organized was scheduled to take place on August 15th of 1953. And on that night, an officer who had been brought into the plot was supposed to arrive at Prime Minister Mossadegh's home around midnight with an order signed by the Shah firing him as Prime Minister. Now, they knew that Mossadegh would refuse to accept this order, since in Iran, which was then a democracy, only parliament had the right to hire and fire prime ministers. And when he resisted, he would be arrested. That was the plan. And the CIA had a general already designated to take over the next day as prime minister of Iran. But what happened? Mossadegh got wind of this plan. And when the officer arrived at Mossadegh's house at midnight, loyal officers stepped out of the shadows. And soon, the officer who was supposed to arrest Mossadegh was himself under arrest. So now the coup had failed. And the Shah, who had been waiting out the results at his resort near the Caspian, immediately fled the country. He went to Baghdad and then on to Rome, where he told people that he was going to be looking for work, since he obviously wouldn't be able to go back to Iran. Now, what neither he nor anyone else knew was that Kermit Roosevelt, despite being ordered by the CIA to come home, decided, I can still do this. I can try again. He was really a true-life James Bond. And on his own, he activated his mobs on the 19th of August, just 4 days later, in a second coup attempt. They rampaged through the streets by the tens of thousands. Many of them, I think, never even really understood that they were being paid by the CIA. They just knew that they'd been given a good day's wage to go out in the street and chant something. Many politicians whipped up the crowds during those days. Roosevelt had been spending $11,000 a week just to bribe members of the Iranian parliament. There were only 90 members, and the average annual income in Iran at that time was about $500. So you can imagine what this sum must have meant. At crucial moments, police and military units joined the crowd. They started storming government buildings. There were gunfights in front of important buildings. The crucial battle, the climactic battle, was actually in front of Prime Minister Mossadegh's house. It started around nightfall. There was heavy gunfire, including an artillery duel. About 100 people were killed just in the battle for Mossadegh's house. Towards the end, however, members of a military unit whose leader Roosevelt had bribed arrived with a column of tanks, and with that, Mossadegh was no longer able to survive. By midnight on August 19th, 1953, his house was in flames, and he had fled over the back garden wall to surrender himself a couple of days later, and the general who the CIA had selected as the designated savior of Iran was installed as prime minister. Now, the Shah was sitting in a restaurant in Rome, imagining that his prospects in Iran were finished, when news correspondents burst in with cables from Tehran saying that a second coup had been attempted and it had succeeded, and that he was now being called upon to return to his throne. According to correspondents who were present, he went into a form of shock, and his color drained out of his face, and his hands started to shake. And when he could finally regain his composure, he said, I knew it. They love me. He flew back to Tehran, and a couple of nights later received Kermit Roosevelt on the last night that Roosevelt spent in Iran before returning to Washington. The two of them toasted each other with vodka, and the Shah said, I owe my throne to God, my people, my army, and you. And he was quite right, although he might have got the order a little mixed up.
We're talking to Stephen Kinzer of New York Times, who's written the book All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. And so the Shah was installed, and very briefly, the effect of this coup.
Kermit Roosevelt came back from his great triumph in Tehran and was brought to the Oval Office to brief President Eisenhower, Secretary of State Dulles, and a few other members of the National Security Team in Washington. He later wrote about this moment, and he said, as I looked over to Secretary of State Dulles, I could see he was intensely interested. He seemed to be grinning like a giant cat. My instinct told me he was planning. Sure enough, only a few weeks later, Kermit Roosevelt was called into his boss's office and told, you know, you did such a great job overthrowing that government in Iran. We've decided we don't like the government down in Guatemala, and we'd like you to go down there and do the same thing again. Well, Kermit Roosevelt demurred, but someone else was found. And less than a year after the democratic government of Iran was overthrown by the CIA, the CIA did the same thing in Guatemala. Now, these two seemingly great successes, purchased with modest effort and relatively low cost, I think really thrilled Secretary of State Dulles and his brother Alan Dulles, the CIA director. Bear in mind, this was a time when the United States could not invade countries of which it disapproved because of the Soviet Union. The Red Army was always a present threat. So here was a way that the U.S. could dispose of governments it didn't like without invading. I think it was the success of the Iran coup and the Guatemala one that followed 10 months later that sent the U.S. government off on this direction of covert action and regime change. The Iran coup was the first time the CIA ever overthrew a government. And Harry Truman never wanted the CIA to go in that direction. I even found a phrase in one of his diaries. He used the phrase American Gestapo to describe what he was afraid the CIA might become if it were allowed to run loose. So he never used it to overthrow governments. But the new administration that came in January 1953 seized onto this tool, and that led us to our adventures in every place from Indonesia to Chile to Cuba to Vietnam to the Congo, and I think grabbed our government, set it off on a certain direction from which it's still recovering.
Stephen Kinzer, New York Times reporter and author of the book All the Shah's Men, describing what happened in 1953, the CIA-backed coup against the democratically elected leader of Iran. As we turn now to a second coup or coup attempt, this took place in April of 2002 against the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez. We're going to play an excerpt of the film, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, produced by Kim Bartley and Donacho Bryan. They are two Irish filmmakers who are in the palace as the attempted ouster of Hugo Chavez was taking place.
At around 10 p.m., members of the military high command arrived in the palace to demand Chavez's resignation. They would not let us enter the room. Sometime later, the first minister arrived out from the president's office. Chavez was refusing to sign a resignation, and in response, the generals were threatening to bomb the palace.
The CIA is behind this. Everyone knows it. We have proof of plans for a coup. They can't destroy history.
By this point, most civilians had been evacuated. Those that remained knew that if the palace was bombed, there would be no way out. At about 3:30 a.m., one of the ministers came out to talk to us. Chavez had decided to hand himself over to the generals to avoid the bombing of the palace, but he was still refusing to resign as president.
It's finally clear that this is a coup. The president has refused to resign.
With 5 minutes left till the bombing deadline expired, Chavez was led away. One hour later, Venezuela awoke to a new regime and to an extraordinary TV moment in which all was revealed.
Good morning. We have a new president. I must thank Venevisión and RCTV. I must say thanks to all the TV channels, thanks to the media.
Gracias Televen, gracias CMT, gracias Globovisión, gracias medios de comunicación.
The palace we had fled only hours before was now the scene of celebrations and backslapping by the coup leaders and their cronies. As the coup generals made themselves at home in the presidential office, the palace guard in their red berets, who yesterday had served Chavez, were now reluctantly at the orders of Carmona.
The newly appointed Attorney General says, "We hereby decree that a democratic transitional government shall be established in the following manner. We hereby dissolve the National Assembly." We also dissolve the Supreme Court. We dismiss the Attorney General, the head of the Central Bank. And the Ombudsman and the National Electoral Board.
Let me share with you the administration's thoughts about what's taking place in Venezuela. We know that the action encouraged by the Chavez government provoked this crisis. The Chavez government suppressed peaceful demonstrations.
White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer.
Unarmed peaceful protesters resulting in 10 killed and 100 wounded. That is what took place, and a transitional civilian government has been installed.
Despite the blackout by the Venezuelan private media, members of Chavez's government have managed to communicate with international television networks, getting the message back to Venezuela via cable TV that Chavez had not resigned and was being held captive. Very quickly, the word began to spread. Chavez had not been seen or heard of since he'd been taken away 2 days earlier. That morning, as we drove around Caracas, the atmosphere was electric. Despite police repression, people had decided to march on the palace. With so many people out on the streets, the palace guard, who had remained loyal to Chavez, decided to act. Behind Carmona's back, a plot was being hatched by Chavez's men to retake the palace. The plan was for the guard to take up key positions, surround the palace, and to wait for a given signal. With all their positions secured, the signal was given, and the presidential guard moved in. Several members of the newly installed government were taken prisoner. But in the confusion, Carmona and the generals had managed to slip away.
La caja fuerte, la vacía.
As the guards secured the building, Chavez's ministers, who had been in hiding for the last 2 days, began to arrive back to the palace to try and re-establish the legitimate cabinet.
Quiero hacer un llamado.
Hugo Chavez says, "Firstly, I want to call for calm today. I have been incomunicado for the last few hours. I had no information and I was very worried.
Lo primero y más importante que digo a todos los venezolanos es que vuelvan a sus casas.
The most important thing I want to say to you is to go back to your homes. We need calm.
Ustedes venezolanos que me adversan, pues adversen.
Those of you who oppose me, fine.
Trataré de que
oppose me.
Hacerlos cambiar, ojalá.
I wish I could change your minds.
Pero no puedo adversar esta constitución.
But you cannot change the
Porque
constitution.
Esto es un libro para todos.
This is the people's book. It's like the Popol Vuh.
El libro de los mayas.
The book of the Mayas.
El Popol Vuh, el libro de todos, el libro de la comunidad.
The book of the community.
Tienes que reconocer todo esto y sobre todo algo.
You have to recognize this.
Oye, no se dejen envenenar.
But most importantly,
no permitan que los envenenen.
Don't be poisoned.
Tantas cosas y tantas mentiras.
Don't let them poison you with their lies. And that an excerpt of the video documentary, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, produced by Kim Bartley and Donacha O'Brien. This is Democracy Now! When we return, we remember a great New Yorican poet. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The famed New Yorican poet Pedro Pietri died on Wednesday at the age of 59. He was born in Puerto Rico. His family moved to Harlem in the 1940s. He would go on to become New York City's one of their best poets, capturing what it was like for Puerto Ricans to live in New York. In the 1970s, he helped start the legendary New Yorican Poets Cafe in the Lower East Side. He wrote more than 20 books of poetry and plays. His best-known work was the epic poem Puerto Rican Obituary. We turn to a documentary about the group Young Lords, where Pedro Pietri is the beginning reading from this poem, Puerto Rican Obituary.
They were always on time. They were never late. They never spoke back when they were insulted. They worked. They never went on strike about permission. They never took days off that were not on the calendar. They worked 10 days a week and were only paid for 5. They worked. They worked. They worked and they died. They died broke. They died owing. They died never knowing what the front entrance of the First National City Bank looks like. Juan, Miguel, Milagro, Olga, Manuel, all die yesterday, today, and will die again tomorrow, passing their bill collectors on to the next of kin. All die waiting for the Garden of Eden to open up again under a new management. All die dreaming about America, waking them up in the middle of the night, screaming, Mira, mira, your name is on the winning lottery ticket for $100,000. All die hating the grocery stores that sold them make-believe steak and bulletproof rice and beans. All die dreaming, hating, and waiting. Dead Puerto Ricans who never knew they were Puerto Ricans, who never took a coffee break from the Ten Commandments to kill, kill, kill the landlord of their cracked skulls and communicate with their Latin souls. Juan, Miguel, Milagro, Olga, Manuel, from the nervous breakdown streets where the mice live like millionaires and the people do not live at all.
Pedro Pietri, reciting his poem, Puerto Rican Obituary, from the film from Third World Newsreel, El Pueblo Se Levanta. I now turn to my co-host, Juan Gonzalez, who yesterday after the program remembered his friend Pedro Pietri, talked about his legacy, and recited his whole poem, Puerto Rican Obituary. This is Juan.
Wednesday night from Pedro Pietri's sister Carmen late that night that she just had word that her brother Pedro had died. Pedro Pietri, the Puerto Rican poet, probably the most important Latino poet in this country in the last 30 or 40 years. I've known Pedro for quite a while. We first met back in 1969 when I was in the Young Lords, and he had just returned from Vietnam. He was actually a member of the first Spanish Methodist Church in East Harlem, the church that the Young Lords occupied, that we took over in 1969 in protest, demanding better services from that church to the Puerto Rican community. And Pedro supported us in that endeavor, even though it created a big rift within his own family. All of his family had been members of the church for a long time, and his sisters and brothers went through a wrenching experience battling their own brother as well as the Young Lords in that situation. And over the years, he was an inspiration to many Puerto Rican activists as his reputation grew, as his poetry expanded and got known throughout the world. He published numerous books of poetry. He was really the founder of the New York Puerto Rican poetry renaissance of the 60s and 70s. And we're all going to miss him tremendously. He was a great inspiration to many people. And just in honor of him, I'd like to read his real epic poem, the one that set off the Puerto Rican poetic and literary renaissance in New York. It's called Puerto Rican Obituary. They worked. They were always on time. They were never late. They never spoke back when they were insulted. They worked. They never took days off that were not on the calendar. They never went on strike without permission. They worked 10 days a week and were only paid for 5. They worked, they worked, they worked, and they died. They died broke. They died owing. They died never knowing what the front entrance of the First National City Bank looks like. Juan, Miguel, Milagros, Olga, Manuel, all died yesterday, today, and will die again tomorrow, passing their bill collectors on to the next of kin, all waiting for the Garden of Eden to open up again under a new management. All died dreaming about America, waking them up in the middle of the night, screaming, "Mira, mira, your name is on the winning lottery ticket for $100,000. All died hating the grocery stores that sold them make-believe steak and bulletproof rice and beans. All died waiting, dreaming, and hating. Dead Puerto Ricans who never knew they were Puerto Ricans, who never took a coffee break from the Ten Commandments to kill, kill, kill the landlords of their cracked skulls and communicate with their Latino souls. Juan, Miguel, Milagros, Olga, Manuel, from the nervous breakdown streets where the mice live like millionaires and the people do not live at all, are dead and were never alive. Juan died waiting for his number to hit. Miguel died waiting for the welfare check to come and go and come again. Milagros died waiting for her 10 children to grow up and work so she could quit working. Olga died waiting for a $5 raise. Manuel died waiting for his supervisor to drop dead so he could get a promotion. It's a long ride from Spanish Harlem to Long Island Cemetery where they are buried. First the train, and then the bus, and the cold cuts for lunch, and the flowers that will be stolen when visiting hours are over is very expensive, is very expensive. But they understand, their parents understood. Is a long nonprofit ride from Spanish Harlem to Long Island Cemetery. Juan, Miguel, Milagros, Olga, Manuel, all died yesterday, today, and will die again tomorrow. Dreaming about Queens, clean-cut, lily-white neighborhood, Puerto Rican Lacene, $30,000 home, the first fix on the block, proud to belong to a community of gringos who want them lynched, proud to be a long distance away from the sacred phrase, ¿Qué pasa? These dreams, these empty dreams, from the make-believe bedrooms their parents left them, are the after effects of television programs about the ideal white American family with black maids and Latino janitors who are well-trained to make everyone and their bill collectors laugh at them and the people they represent. Juan died dreaming about a new car. Miguel died dreaming about new anti-poverty programs. Milagros died dreaming about a trip to Puerto Rico. Olga died dreaming about real jewelry. Manuel died dreaming about the Irish sweepstakes. They all died like a hero sandwich dies in the garment district at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. Social Security number to ashes, union dues to dust. They knew they were born to weep and keep the morticians employed as long as they pledge allegiance to the flag that wants them destroyed. They saw their names listed in the telephone directory of destruction.
They were trained to turn the other cheek by newspapers that misspelled, mispronounced, and misunderstood their names and celebrated when death came and stole their final laundry ticket. They were born dead, and they died dead. It's time to visit Sister Lopez again, the number one dealer, healer, and fortune card dealer in Spanish Harlem. She can communicate with your late relatives for a reasonable fee. Good news is guaranteed. Rise, table, death is not dumb and disabled. Those who love you want to know the correct number to play. Let them know this right away. Rise, table, death is not dumb and disabled. Now that your problems are over and the world is off your shoulders, help those who you left behind find financial peace of mind. Rise, table, death is not dumb and disabled. If the right number we hit, all our problems will split, and we will visit your grave on every legal holiday. Those who love you want to know the correct number to play. Let them know this right away. We know your spirit is able. Death is not dumb and disabled. Rise, table.
Juan, Miguel, Milagros, Olga, Manuel, all died yesterday, today, and will die again tomorrow. Hating, fighting, and stealing broken windows from each other. Practicing a religion without a roof. The Old Testament, the New Testament, according to the gospel of the Internal Revenue, the judge and jury, an executioner, protector, and eternal bill collector. Second, ill. Learn how to say, como está usted, and you will make a fortune. They are dead. They are dead and will not return from the dead until they stop neglecting the art of their dialogue for broken English lessons to impress the bosses who keep them employed as lavaplatos, porters, messenger boys, factory workers, maids, stock clerks, shipping clerks, assistant, mailroom assistant, assistant, assistant to the assistant's assistant, assistant lavaplatos, and automatic artificial smiling doorman for the lowest wages of the ages and rages when you demand a raise because it's against the company policy to promote spics. Juan died hating Miguel because Miguel's used car was in better condition than his used car. Miguel died hating Milagros because Milagros had a color television set and he could not afford one yet. Milagros died hating Olga because Olga made $5 more on the same job. Olga died hating Manuel because Manuel had hit the numbers more times than she had hit the numbers. Manuel died hating all of them. Juan, Miguel, Milagros, and Olga, because they all spoke broken English more fluently than he did. And now they are together in the main lobby of the void, addicted to silence, off limits to the wind, confined to worm supremacy in Long Island Cemetery. This is the groovy hereafter the Protestant collection box was talking so loud and proud about. Here lies Juan, here lies Miguel, here lies Milagros. Here lies Olga, here lies Manuel, who died yesterday, today, and will die again tomorrow. Always broke, always owing, never knowing that they are beautiful people, never knowing the geography of their complexion. Puerto Rico is a beautiful place. Puerto Ricanos are a beautiful race. If only they had turned off the television and tuned into their own imaginations. If only they had used the white supremacy Bibles for toilet paper purpose and make their Latino souls the only religion of their race. If only they had returned to the definition of the sun after the first mental snowstorm on the summer of their senses. If only they had kept their eyes open at the funeral of their fellow employees who came to this country to make a fortune and were buried without underwears. Juan, Miguel, Milagros, Olga, Manuel will right now be doing their own thing, where beautiful people sing and dance and work together, where the wind is a stranger to miserable weather conditions, where you do not need a dictionary to communicate with your people. Aquí se habla español all the time. Aquí you salute your flag first. Aquí there are no Dial soap commercials. Aquí everybody smells good. Aquí TV dinners do not have a future. Aquí the men and women admire, desire, and never get tired of each other. Aquí que pasa, power is what's happening. Aquí to be called negrito means to be called love. And thank you to Pedro Pietri for all your great contributions to our people.
Juan Gonzalez, reading Pedro Pietri's famous poem, Puerto Rican Obituary.
Pedro died on Wednesday night of stomach cancer. He was flying back from Mexico, where he was seeking alternative treatment. He died en route. This is Democracy Now! As we end today's program with Jason West, mayor of New Paltz. In New York City, dozens of same-sex couples gathered outside City Hall yesterday demanding marriage rights. They were turned away. Meanwhile, north of the city, in New Paltz, the village is continuing to give marriage licenses, even though the mayor has been charged with 19 counts of breaking New York's marriage law. New Paltz Mayor Jason West joins us on the phone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jason.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, can you tell us about your decision to defy the law? Do you see it as doing that?
Actually, I see it as my decision to uphold the law. There's actually one clarification. We're not issuing marriage licenses here, and New York State doesn't require them. Article 3, Section 25 of Domestic Relations Law says as long as the marriage is properly solemnized, you don't need a license as long as it's been properly solemnized. And that's what I've solemnized these marriages. As for why I chose to do it, our state constitution requires equal protection under the law. Our laws are gender neutral. They don't mention the gender of people who get married. And, you know, I took an oath of office last June to uphold that constitution, and that's what I intend to continue to do.
So what does it mean? You have pled not guilty?
I pled not guilty, yeah.
Why are you being charged in a way that the other mayors in Oregon, in San Francisco, are not?
Because there's a clause, and this is the DA's contention, there's a clause in the domestic relations law that says if a wedding is solemnized and the person who solemnizes it knows the people involved don't have a license, that's a misdemeanor. And I've been charged with 19 counts of marrying people knowing they didn't have a license. It's interesting that not one person has challenged the legality of the marriages themselves. They're charging the fact that I shouldn't perform more of them. But no one is. There's no lawsuits and no question in the press that these people are legally married in New York State.
Who are some of the people you've married?
My good friends Billiam and Major Jeffrey McGowan were the first couple. Jeffrey is a retired major in the U.S. Army. He served in the 82nd Airborne during the first Gulf War. Three of the couples had children. It was one of the most touching moments was one of the couples, their daughter Rebecca, who was 7 years old, was dressed all in white as a flower girl and walked through 500 strangers in the national media throwing flowers in front of her two moms before they were married. The final couple I married was one of whose name I can't remember at the moment. I just met most of them that morning. Was a survivor of the World Trade Center bombings. He was pulled out of the towers 5 minutes before they collapsed and had to be helped to the stage. He had difficulty walking.
When do you go to trial?
I've been told 3 weeks, as far as I know. I was arraigned on Wednesday, and I go back in 3 weeks.
What is the sentence you face?
A fine, and that's all. There's the potential for jail time, but the district attorney has said he's not interested in pursuing that. So at this point, I'm just facing a fine.
Well, Jason West, it sounds like you've also inspired the mayor of Nyack to do the same, Nyack, New York.
I met with John Shields, the mayor of Nyack, Wednesday morning, and he announced that day that he was going to do the same. I think he's since shifted. He's spoken to some lawyers who had suggested that the mayor of Nyack himself is gay, and he went down to his own town hall and requested a marriage license for himself and his partner and was denied and got that in writing, that the denial was based on the sex of the couples involved.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there.
Great.
I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
New Paltz Mayor Jason West. And that does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Shroof Abdo-Kudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Rich Kim is engineering as well. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.